From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. About 2 hours from now, we will hear a decision from the president about whether the U.S. will stay in or withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. We already know what the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases is doing. China is staying in. Joining us now is the BBC's Jenny Hill. She's in Berlin. Jenny, tell us more about what China is saying today about the Paris Accord.
Well, the Chinese Prime Minister is in Berlin. He's been holding talks with Angela Merkel, and Li Keqiang this morning confirmed at a press conference that China would continue to honour its commitment to the Paris Climate Treaty. That, of course, is music to the ears of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She was one of the real drivers behind that treaty, and I think she and, frankly, Germany as a whole is certainly disappointed and in some quarters pretty disgusted, actually, by President Trump's apparent refusal thus far to cooperate with the other G7 countries, in particular when it comes to climate protection policy. So people here in Berlin are very, very anxious to see what he's got to say about the Paris Treaty this afternoon, but I think they're preparing themselves for disappointment.
So the fact that they're coming out and saying we're staying in the Paris Agreement, is that a message to President Trump? Are they trying to sway him in some way?
I think two things are going on here. I think, first of all, perhaps a cynic might argue that the Chinese see an opportunity here. They are able to stand shoulder to shoulder with other EU leaders and say, you know, we're going to work together on this. They're very keen, of course, for a free trade deal with the EU. They're very keen to strengthen those economic and political ties. So, you know, arguably, there's something in this for them too. On the other hand, you've then got Angela Merkel, who I think is sending a strong signal across the Atlantic to President Trump. Now, make no mistake, she's very much in favour of keeping that transatlantic relationship alive. She has to. Germany is reliant on the US. It's got a great trading relationship. They need to cooperate on areas like security and defence. On the other hand, she's got an electorate who don't like Donald Trump. They don't like his politics. They don't like his rhetoric. Angela Merkel's got an election coming up. It does her good to be seen to be publicly standing up to Donald Trump. And then you've got something else going on, which is, I think, Angela Merkel is a very pragmatic realist kind of leader. She can see, and you know she's said this out loud, that some of her traditional allies, and she's talking really about the US here, cannot be completely relied upon anymore. And so she's looking at other directions in which to take Germany and EU foreign policy. And whilst these meetings were pre-planned, it's very timely, I think, that she met the Prime Minister of India yesterday, the Prime Minister of China now, and in both cases pledged to strengthen cooperation and economic and political ties with both of them.
If you were to walk around a city in the United States, in some places you would find people who think that the Paris Climate Agreement is a great idea and that the U.S. needs to stay in it. And in some places you would find people who'd say, good, get out of that agreement. We don't need to be part of this international agreement, especially if, as they feel, it's going to hurt jobs. How do people in Europe, how do the streets of Europe feel about this Paris Agreement?
Well, I think certainly here in Germany, they're very much in favour of it. My experience of living in Germany tells me that, you know, the majority of people you meet are very, very concerned about the environment. You know, you want to see the recycling bins in my backyard. You know, people are very careful about their environment and about protecting it. Now, look, having said that, you know, Germany doesn't have the greatest track record when it comes to climate protection, although, of course, that is changing. And Angela Merkel has, as I said, been very much that driving force behind trying to get, I suppose, a worldwide strategy on this. And people here have been disappointed by Donald Trump's policy, if you like, although, of course, we're still waiting to hear exactly what he thinks about it. But they've been alarmed. You know, you walk down the corridors of power here in Berlin and MPs are really alarmed by the rhetoric we heard during his election campaign and since he's been in office when it comes in particular to climate change. But, you know, I think really here in Europe, this goes well beyond just climate change. For Angela Merkel, some of the noises coming from Donald Trump on all sorts of policy areas are ones which are ringing alarm bells.
That's the BBC's Jenny Hill joining us from Berlin. Jenny, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Well, while we wait for the president's plans on climate change, we know his proposal to cut food stamps. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, provides less than $2 per person per meal, but 44 million Americans received it in 2016. The bulk, 4 out of 5 of them, were children, seniors, the disabled, and poor working parents. The remainder are able-bodied, non-working, childless adults, and the president's proposed budget would expand a work requirement for them. It would also cut the total program by $192 billion over the next 10 years to cut out fraud and abuse. So how much is there? Diane Whitmore-Schatzenbach is with the Brookings Institution. Professor Diane, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Professor, let's get right to the criticism from people like Ed Fulner, who's founder of the Heritage Foundation, who says there's been an uptick in the number of working-age, able-bodied adults on SNAP who are not working. And this is because he and others attribute this to the fact that there was a waiver of the work requirement during the Great Recession for these able-bodied adults because there were no jobs. You know, he and others are saying, take that waiver away, put the work requirement back. What's wrong with that?
The way that the program is supposed to work is to be able to expand in times of bad economic downturns and retract in good economic times. And so under the current design of the program, many places that had temporary waivers of these time limits for working-age, able-bodied adults are seeing those time limits reinstated. And that's just the normal operating procedure of SNAP now. When times are good, time limit gets reinstated, and when times are bad, when jobs are not plentiful, we will no longer enforce this time limit just temporarily until the economy turns back around. And I'll remind you that over the last couple of years, we've seen a steady decline in the number of people who are participating in SNAP because the economy has started cooking again and more people have been able to get jobs and, you know, get back into the economy and not rely on these benefits anymore.
That's true. The number did drop in 2014. The arc is down. However, it has shot up so high, and that's where the concern is. What is the sense of fraud and abuse?
The Department of Agriculture keeps good statistics on fraud and abuse, and they're at all-time lows. So the numbers are on the order of 2 or 3%. So this is really a model of a program that is well-functioning.
Well, what about the way SNAP money is used? The USDA released data from a leading grocery store in 2011. It showed that SNAP households spent $1.9 billion, or about 20% of food stamps, on sweetened beverages, frozen prepared food desserts, high-fat dairy. Some states, Arkansas, Tennessee, are asking that these foods be banned from the program. Thoughts?
What's important to understand is that most families combine their SNAP benefits with their other cash resources. So when they go to the grocery store, you know, only a fraction of what they're buying in total is coming from their SNAP benefits. And then they also use, you know, their earnings or, you know, other sources to buy their total grocery cart. So on average, SNAP participants spend about $14 a month on sugar-sweetened beverages. Banning the purchase of that from food stamps will, at least we predict, will have people shift from using the SNAP benefits to purchase that $14 worth of soda and using their own cash instead. So yeah. You know, even though it seems like it's a good idea, in practice, I think it's unlikely to change behavior.
What about Wisconsin's governor, Scott Walker? He's proposing drug testing able-bodied recipients of food stamps in his state. Now, officials at the USDA say it's illegal. But this idea of somehow tying behavior to receipt of a benefit, do we know if that works?
I think there's evidence from other social welfare programs that indicate that very, very few people, when subject to these random drug tests, you know, are kicked off the program, come up positive, et cetera. So I think generally economists think that those types of programs aren't worth their cost.
Well, and the move by the president and the White House is to get people off of food stamps to work. We've already said, you know, a huge number of food stamp recipients are already working. The amount of money received with food stamps is really quite small, a few hundred dollars a month for a family. Obviously, you know, very useful. But
you wouldn't want to live on it.
Right. And most people have to work who receive the food stamps. But the LA Times reported this week that Los Angeles County officials are trying to get more people enrolled in the food stamp program there. That's CalFresh. Only 66% of Californians who are eligible are enrolled. Now, other states, let's say Tennessee enrolls 99%. Oregon has 100% of eligible recipients, it claims, on the rolls. But at least in one state, not even everyone who could qualify has applied.
That's right. In many cases, when people don't take up these SNAP benefits and so on, it's often because they're eligible for relatively modest amounts. So, you know, a lot of times that's the minimum of $16 per month. And so you can imagine that in some cases, you know, people will say, oh, that's not worth my time. It's such a modest amount. But there are other drivers as well, and that includes stigma and just the time cost of having to go down to the benefits office, which is increasingly difficult when more and more people on this program are also working.
That's Diane Whitmore-Schatzenbach of the Brookings Institution. She's also a social policy professor at Northwestern University. Professor Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now. In the new Netflix film War Machine, Brad Pitt plays a fictionalized version of the real-life General Stanley McChrystal, who commanded American forces in Afghanistan in 2009 and 10.
I don't seem to be getting any traction. Do you know what I'm saying? Traction? We got ourselves a president who appears not to be aware of the fact that the United States is at war right now, and he's that war's commander-in-chief.
Well, it was comments like that about then-President Obama that got General McChrystal fired after they were exposed by journalist Michael Hastings in that sensational 2010 Rolling Stone story, The Runaway General. Hastings also famously quoted a McChrystal aide saying, "Bite me," when referring to Vice President Biden. Here's Hastings speaking to CNN after McChrystal was fired.
If the White House wanted to keep General McChrystal, they could have easily done that. They could have, there's a number of ways they could have swept this under the rug. So I think actually their response confirms what I wrote in the story, which was the relationship between General McChrystal and the White House was obviously fraught with tension.
Journalist Michael Hastings in 2010, he was killed in a car crash in 2013 at just 33. And now this new film based on his reporting. Washington Post reporter Greg Jaffe also covered the war in Afghanistan. He brought a friend with him to see War Machine at a screening. That friend is retired Lieutenant Colonel Jason Dempsey, who served in Afghanistan. They both join us now with a movie review with a unique perspective. Greg, let's start with the review. Brad Pitt as General McChrystal. What did you think of it?
You know, I thought it wasn't a convincing portrayal of McChrystal. I think he kind of played him as a buffoon, and I thought that that's a little bit of a missed opportunity. McChrystal was a thoughtful commander who definitely had his weak points and made his mistakes, but there was a lot good there, and including real concern sort of about civilian casualties in Afghanistan and a real sense of empathy and compassion for the Afghan people.
Well, but as the lights come up after you watch this screening, you turn to Lieutenant Colonel Dempsey and say, "Wow, that was the most anti-military movie I can remember seeing." And Colonel Dempsey, you say what?
Well, that's why I liked it. And I think, but to carry on with Greg's point, the interesting thing about the movie was it decidedly was not a portrayal of Stan McChrystal. And I think it's worth repeating that Stan McChrystal is probably one of the most talented, brilliant officers that this nation has produced, at least in my generation. But the point and the irony of the movie was, how do you get such a massively talented person in country, but he appears to be in a system, both political and military, that has no chance of success?
Yeah, and what happens then? But let's focus a little more on McChrystal, because Greg Jaffe, especially after Michael Hastings' article, he did come across as what you say he was, kind of tone deaf, but also compassionate and smart. You talk about something McChrystal wrote in his autobiography describing a U.S. raid in which an Iraqi man is demeaned in front of his four-year-old, and what McChrystal felt at that moment. And you contrast that with how he's depicted in the film. Could you remind us what McChrystal said about his thoughts in that moment?
So McChrystal was on this raid, and as he tells the story in the autobiography, the Special Forces soldiers that he's accompanying, the U.S. soldiers, make this Iraqi father of a four-year-old lie on the ground face down with guns pointed at him. And his four-year-old son watches this and repeats the same gesture. He falls to the floor and presses his face against the concrete like his father. And McChrystal remembers watching this and looking at the expression on the dad's face and thinking, you know, we've just demeaned and humiliated this man. If we are doing this on a nightly basis, there's just no way we could win this war.
Right. And he also says, "I felt sick. I could feel in my own limbs and chest the same shame and fury that must have been coursing through that father. And I thought, not for the first time, it would be easy for us to lose." But then, Greg, you described the McChrystal in the film. The first guy, the one you met in Afghanistan, you see in that quote from his book, the second guy on film is a moron.
Yeah, it was sort of, we can't kill him and help him at the same time. It's just impossible, so we're not going to kill him. And to be honest, I think that was the McChrystal that kind of came across a little bit in Michael Hastings' Rolling Stone article. I think Hastings got a lot right. I think he also got a lot wrong in that initial article. And it's worth remembering at the time that the article was sensational, and it was also very controversial in the moment when it came out.
But Lieutenant Colonel Dempsey, what about that? You know, is a top commander supposed to speak about his commander-in-chief in the field the way that McChrystal did to Hastings?
Well, so there's an interesting thing about that article, because I pored over it very closely, and in fact, there were no derogatory statements attributed directly to McChrystal. Hmm. And so you can say that, yep, it's his staff, and as he did, he accepted responsibility for the things his staff said and did. But he himself was fairly straight arrow, even throughout the whole article. And what it reflected, and again, I was not a fan of Hastings at the time, was the idea that if somebody's going to spend 2 weeks around the clock with you, and I used to say this to people who'd worked in the White House, you would probably say something to get yourself fired. Mm. And so the way Hastings went about the article, I did not think was appropriate or fair or met good journalistic standards. But at the end of the day, I do think the president was boxed in because there were quotes on record of military personnel making derogatory statements about the chain of command. And so it became a fairly clear civil-military control issue.
Right, that he had to respond, President Obama did, in the way that he did. Well, what about what else the film gets right or wrong about the military? Greg, you describe a sort of bubble that America's four-star commanders exist in, aides who shield them from bad news, cut off from politics and reality. Lieutenant Colonel Dempsey, is that right?
It absolutely is. And the irony of all of this is that there are no true villains in our unfolding, slow-rolling Afghanistan catastrophe. Everybody goes over there with good intentions. The problem is the military has set up a system whereby we are rotating people in and out constantly. And so each gets to set his or her own definition of success for the 9 to 12 months that they're going to be in country. And so what we have after 11, 12 years of fairly concerted effort and 16 years since the initial invasion of Afghanistan is a bunch of military officers who've blown through and said, well, I made a difference. But nobody has ever stepped back and said, well, if you add all that up, are we actually going in the right direction?
Yeah. The famous slogan that everyone wants to put on coffee cups is, we were winning the war when I left.
Hmm. Well, staying with the movie, Greg Jaffe, you also remind us the only face-to-face meeting General McChrystal has with President Obama is when he gets fired. Is there some disconnect there?
Yeah, no, I do think that there's a disconnect there. I mean, the president's got a lot of other priorities, but when you're sending this many people off to war and you're putting a commander like McChrystal in charge, there needs to be some dialogue there. I think what President Obama was responding to at the time was that he felt like the military had too much power. You know, if you remember in Iraq during the surge, General Petraeus essentially ran the war, and President Bush's response was, I'm going to do what Petraeus recommends. I'm going to do what my generals recommend. And he had weekly teleconferences with Petraeus. I'm not sure that was the right solution either. And so I think President Obama tended to overcorrect, which meant not meeting with his generals at all. Rarely, I should say.
Well, back to our movie review with, again, Greg Jaffe of The Washington Post and Lieutenant Colonel Jason Dempsey. Greg, you write, again, you don't like the movie that much. You say the generals are cartoonish buffoons, obsessed with their legacies, contemptuous of the U.S. civilians they serve. The troops are mostly angry and alone. The Afghans are largely drug addicts. So it does seem a little cartoonish. But Lieutenant Colonel Dempsey, we also hear about, you know, what seems just, it seems somewhat cartoonish in a way. I mean, I know you were in a life and death situation when you were in Afghanistan, but you fired an Afghan who then ends up a little while later being rehired.
Right. And one thing we'd never acknowledged was the reality of Afghanistan. And this is where, you know, whenever I hear generals or politicians say, well, we're not making progress in Afghanistan because everybody's corrupt. They don't have a good rule of law. I interpret that very simply as our strategy for Afghanistan would be working perfectly if only Afghanistan was a different country. And to me, that's kind of where some of the absurdity is captured in the movie. It's this idea that we're going to create a new nation out of whole cloth and that somehow we can rotate guys in and out and take a very superficial approach to changing the country and not acknowledge that there are widespread and deep underlying political dynamics that we don't even understand.
Yeah. Well, we saw that terrible bombing in Afghanistan yesterday. There was also a White House meeting about Afghanistan strategy yesterday. Look, Lieutenant Colonel Dempsey, do you remember the email that you sent to Greg, you know, afterwards, after the movie screen?
Yeah, I do. I do. The bottom line is War Machine really is an absurd movie. You can't take it as this is a realistic portrayal of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines and how they go to war, but you can take it as a very poignant and very accurate take on kind of the hubris and arrogance with which we've approached the Afghan conflict. And so it almost wasn't absurd enough. And part of that would be, what is it about the military bureaucracy and the way we've set up this fight, the way we've manned it, the way we've resourced it, such that the entire military can roll in and think they're making a difference, but the end result is ultimately failure? And particularly with this idea now that we're going to send 5,000 or so troops back into Afghanistan, and I have yet to hear a policymaker, senior military leader articulate how these 5,000 are going to make a difference when 100,000 could not 5 years ago.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. And you know what? I'd love to have you both back to talk about perhaps the way forward at another time. But for now, our film reviewers, Lieutenant Colonel Jason Dempsey and Washington Post reporter Greg Jaffe, speaking about the new Netflix film War Machine, starring Brad Pitt. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Uber lost around $700 million in the first quarter, according to multiple media reports. That is a big loss, but it is less than what Uber lost in the previous quarter. And the loss comes after a number of high-profile staff departures. Star engineer Anthony Lewandowski was fired earlier this week, and we learned today that the company's head of finance is also leaving for another startup. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Uber is not a public company, so it doesn't have to report its finances, but they told the Wall Street Journal that the revenue was up about 20% in the first quarter. But there was still this big $700 million loss. What's happening with Uber?
Well, that loss is actually smaller than it was last quarter. The company still has $7 billion cash on hand. So it's tough to read into these numbers too much. They're going in the right direction for Uber. But honestly, like, Uber could become profitable tomorrow if it wanted to. It could just stop going into new markets. It could raise its prices a bit. It could stop investing in self-driving cars. So it's hard without seeing more stuff behind the numbers, how many new riders they're getting, things like that, to know really how well they're doing. But basically, these top-line numbers show that things are going in the right direction.
The company is just still having to spend money to establish itself in these new markets.
Right. And it's just not clear, is it doing that efficiently or not?
We mentioned Anthony Lewandowski, who was accused in a lawsuit of stealing self-driving car technology from Google. What does his departure mean for that lawsuit against Uber and for the company's push into self-driving cars?
Yeah, Uber pretty much had to let him go. They were just going to be tainted by these questions and looked like they were condoning whatever behavior happened. Still, what happened is a big question, but he has taken the fifth. And so it's kind of this soap opera ordeal, but basically Uber tried to get him to testify. He didn't. And so they had to sort of cut their ties to protect themselves as a company.
But beyond him, we've seen other departures. As we mentioned, the head of finance there leaving. More than a dozen executives and managers have left Uber this year alone.
That looks troubling, right? It's hard to say, though. Even like the chief of finance replaced somebody else who left to go join a startup 2 years ago. It's normal with fast-growing companies that you have people who just don't know how to handle whatever business problem is in front of them before because they're not experienced at that level yet. And so it's common to replace a lot of these people as the company grows, as intense as it is for Uber. So
it's also normal in these startups in the tech industry for nothing to last very long. Even if it's going well, people leave, they go to other places.
Yeah, although Uber's not necessarily a company that you would leave just, you know,
right,
on your own volition, because it should be such an exciting place to work.
Well, I guess a little bit of good news for Uber is that they're back in Austin, Texas this week after a while away.
Yeah, so there was a standoff there between local authorities and Uber and Lyft, ride-hailing app services. And basically, this was over whether drivers had to be fingerprinted.
Right.
the governor of Texas, also there in Austin, signed a law basically making the state responsible. And so that takes that requirement away. They can come back in. So it's a victory for those two companies that they didn't have to kind of cave into municipal authorities too much.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Kurt, thank you.
You got it.
Despite terrorist attacks and a warning from the State Department, Americans are still heading to Europe this summer. The Globus Travel Agency told the New York Times traffic to some destinations is up as much as 30% over last year. Geralyn Gerba is co-founder and editorial director for the travel website FathomAway.com. So, Geralyn, what is drawing people to Europe this summer?
Well, it's kind of a beautiful thing. There's a resilience. Americans won't really be deterred. They want to see the sights in Paris and London, and they're going
to
go.
Well, it's also cheaper to go because of the dollar.
It is, and I think that's probably economics is driving it more than a fear factor. So in particular in London, for example, tourism is up more than 30%.
Well, we've seen deals for air and lodging for under $1,000. This is in Europe, you know, for a long stay there. What kind of deals are you seeing? Where are people going?
Well, it's really interesting. So on the one hand, we have people going to these iconic classic European tour destinations, London, Paris, Barcelona, Dublin. But there's also a renewed interest, or maybe a first-time interest, in places a little bit more off the beaten path. So we're seeing and hearing a lot from readers who want to go to Scandinavia for the first time, who want to look into Eastern Europe. So we're seeing a lot of deals in Estonia, in Slovenia, of course, around the Mediterranean. Greece is having a strong comeback, particularly in the islands, Croatia, etc. Portugal is a big destination that people seem to be talking about a lot.
Well, you know, you say off the beaten track, and that's what we're hearing from security consultants. I'm looking at a recent piece in the New York Times. They're saying they're advising travelers to go off the beaten track. Don't go to big Western-owned hotels. Go to family-owned hotels, smaller family-owned restaurants. And also, you know, don't wear ostentatious Western gear like a Yankees hat or, you know, lots of jewelry. What are you telling people about security?
Well, you know, as travelers, we're also global citizens. So we always tell people that they need to be alert and aware of the possibility of danger wherever they go. But it's important to realize and remember that the destinations that are targeted are no more dangerous than they were before the attack. And then in terms of the destinations that you go to, of course, go and explore the uncharted places in the world. Go and, you know, find landmarks and new monuments and develop new rituals in places that people aren't talking about as much. So both are important.
Well, what about buying insurance? Travel insurance often doesn't cover a lot. You have to be careful about what you get. What are you recommending people get?
Yeah, so one thing that's important to note is fear is not a qualifier to get out of a trip. But insurance can be used to help out in a place where there has been an attack. Insurance has been going up because of the instances, not just terrorism, but also things like Zika. And so if you are booking a trip and then find out you're pregnant and then want to cancel your trip because you're going to a Zika-related area, then that insurance will work in that case, for example.
You should also look to see if your insurance covers an incident that might happen while you're traveling.
Exactly. So in the case of Paris, where a lot of things are shut down after those sustained terrorist attacks, travelers didn't really have a place to go. So then they would be able to use their insurance to get back sooner.
Yeah. There's also something called PhoneTrack. This is an updated app from Global Secure. They deliver security alerts in the event of emergency and monitor users' locations, so they ask you to check in while you're traveling. These services cost, in this case, I think it's $12 a month, so you have to check out whether you want to go that far. But we're hearing overall the most important thing to do is get your face out of your iPhone and pay attention to what's around you.
Of course. I mean, there are great things that technology provides. You can sign up for the State Department's STEP program, which is the Smart Traveler Enrollment Program. But it registers your trip, and you can get messages relevant to the area during your dates. But also, before I go to a place, I would sign up for a Google Alert. While I'm there, I would try to read the local newspaper and just keep in touch with people. Talk to people wherever you're going. And try to avoid, you know, that ugly American sojourn. Try to figure out what it would be like to act like a local and then act that way.
Yeah. Well, and Americans are going. Geralyn Gerba, co-founder and editorial director for FathomAway.com. Geralyn, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
With so many Americans getting ready to travel this summer, the Zika virus is back in the spotlight. More than 5,000 cases of the mosquito-borne disease were reported in the U.S. last year. And health officials say at least 64 babies in the United States were born with birth defects linked to the virus. The most well-known is microcephaly, a condition in which the brain does not develop properly. The result is a smaller-than-normal head. Scott Weaver is the director of the Institute for Human Infections and Immunity at the University of Texas Medical Branch. He joins us on Skype. Scott, what is the state of the Zika virus worldwide right now?
Well, we know that the virus is still circulating in much of Latin America, probably also in the Caribbean, and recent studies have shown that there's also active circulation in parts of Southeast Asia, and most recently, infections have been detected in India. So the virus, as well as in Africa, we assume, the virus is really almost worldwide in the tropics.
And is it likely to be as bad a year this year as last year?
Well, it's hard to know for sure, but we're cautiously optimistic that we're going to see fewer imported travel cases this year. That's based on our experience with a very similar virus called chikungunya that swept through the area 2 years earlier. We had a lot of imported cases in 2014, most of which probably came from the Caribbean, like we now think the Zika cases last year were coming from. And chikungunya cases after 2014, imported cases dropped very quickly by 2015 because we think that a lot of people in the Caribbean had already been infected and were immune, and that reduced the efficiency of the virus circulation to infect travelers. So we're hoping that that will be the situation this year with Zika. We'll see fewer imported cases, and that would also, of course, reduce the risk that we would see local chains of transmission beginning in places like Florida and the Rio Grande Valley here in Texas.
Well, if there are no imported cases this year in Florida and Texas, are those states in the clear? Is there any mosquito left, as far as we know, in the United States with Zika?
Well, we certainly still have mosquitoes that are capable of transmitting the virus, and we're certainly going to continue to see some imported cases. Hopefully the numbers will just be lower than they were last year, but each of those imported cases carries with it a risk to begin the transmission cycle here. So we're certainly not out of the woods, and even a single traveler can start an outbreak like we saw in the Miami area or the Brownsville area last summer and fall.
As we look back on what happened last year, what was an effective way to deal with Zika virus? What did we do right?
Well, I think what we did right was to educate travelers. The Centers for Disease Control put out a lot of very good information, especially to warn pregnant women to cancel or at least postpone their travel plans if they were going to an endemic area, and then also to educate partners of pregnant women, as well as anybody. We have to remember with Zika, a person can travel to Latin America, the Caribbean, they can return completely without symptoms, but still be infected and still have the risk of starting transmission here. So we need to continue to educate everybody traveling to those areas to try to take some simple measures to reduce their exposure to mosquitoes when they return, especially if they live in the southern half of the United States, where the main mosquito vector, Aedes aegypti, is very common, for example, here along the Gulf Coast or in Florida.
Are we any closer to a vaccine for Zika?
We are closer. In fact, the speed of vaccine development for Zika has really been unprecedented. And there are a lot of vaccines that are working their way through the development pipeline. Some of them have now begun what we call phase two clinical trials, where larger numbers of people are receiving the vaccine to see if it's safe, if it induces an immune reaction, and possibly even to see if it protects against disease or infection by Zika virus, because some of these trials are being done in endemic areas. Unfortunately, we still probably have at least a couple of years to go before a vaccine can move completely through the approval system with the Food and Drug Administration or the equivalent in other parts of the world to be licensed and available for general use.
That's Scott Weaver, who is the director of the Institute for Human Infections and Immunity at the University of Texas Medical Branch, talking with us about Zika virus. Scott, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And by the way, Scott still advises pregnant women and women who may become pregnant to avoid unnecessary travel to areas where the Zika virus has been reported. Two people struggling to make ends meet, looking for work and battling an unwieldy and seemingly uncaring welfare system. A story from Northeast England as portrayed in a film that opens in theaters in this country tomorrow. It's called I, Daniel Blake, and it won the top prize at last year's Cannes International Film Festival. Howie Movshevitz reports that it's the latest from one of Britain's greatest living filmmakers, Ken Loach.
The screen is black, then a pleasant voice.
Good morning, Mr. Blake. My name's Amanda.
Daniel Blake is being assessed as to whether he can go back to work after a heart attack.
Can you raise either arm to the top of your head as if you were putting on a hat?
I've told you there's nothing wrong with me arms and legs.
Could you just answer the question, please?
Well, you've got me medical records. Can we just talk about me heart?
She works for a private company contracted by the government to manage benefits for those out of work.
Do you ever experience any loss of control leading to extensive evacuation of the bowel?
No, but I can't guarantee there won't be a first if we'd even get to the point.
Can you complete a simple task as setting an alarm clock?
They are expected to sanction a certain number of people each week.
Filmmaker Ken Loach is using the polite language of the bureaucracy. Sanction here means punish or cut from the roles.
We saw a letter where all the people, they're called job coaches, who are supposed to check whether people are really looking for work or not, that the job coaches were listed with the number of sanctions they'd given out each week. The top three were highlighted. And the accompanying letter was to the effect that these three are satisfactory, the rest of you got to buck up.
Loach and his crew visited job centres and hostels to interview Britons living on the edge, and also those whose job it is to help them. Loach's characters face 52-page forms and robotic bureaucrats with a mix of pathos and humour.
There is a grim comedy about it. It's absurd, it's comic, and it's really dark. But I think that people do respond with humour. Gallows humour, call it, or it's the humour of the soldiers in the trenches.
What is funny at first becomes horribly unfunny when you see the consequences.
Pamela Hutchinson is a freelance film critic who's written for The Guardian and Sight and Sound. She points to a scene at a food bank where Daniel Blake's friend rips into a can of nuts she's been given because she's been starving herself to feed her two children.
Oh God, Dan, I feel like I'm going under.
Look, you'll get through this, darling. You'll get through this. Kate, listen to me. This isn't your fault.
It's almost too unbearable to watch.
You've done nothing to be ashamed of.
It came straight out of the research that the writer and the director did into who was using food banks and who was having difficulties with these benefits. And to see that on screen and to know that it will remain there and people can always see that and they'll know what's going on in UK in 2016, I think that's very powerful.
What's happened, says Ken Loach, is a deliberate attempt by the government to force the poor to carry the burden of austerity programs.
There's a knowingness into this cruelty. That's what's shocking. You know, we're all used to inefficiency. This is using inefficiency as a political weapon.
I, Daniel Blake, is overtly political. It's been criticized by the British government as an unrealistic portrayal of the problems. But British newspapers have run articles profiling what they've called real Daniel Blakes. Loach says he wanted to use his camera to give his characters the kind of dignity the benefits system denies them.
You just stand back and observe in a quiet, maybe sympathetic way, through the framing, through the lighting, through the lens you use. You can encourage the viewer to see them as another person of equal value, of equal importance, and to relate to them and to have a solidarity with them.
The star of the film, Dave Johns, has said Loach helped him relate to a problem he hadn't thought much about. Film critic Pamela Hutchinson says I, Daniel Blake is the latest work in the director's long career of socially engaged filmmaking.
Without a shadow of a doubt, Ken Loach is one of Britain's greatest working filmmakers. And a few years ago, he had retired. And he basically said when the Conservative government won the general election spring 2015, he decided to get back on it and make another film because he realised there was going to be something there for him to protest against.
Loach himself is a realist. He doesn't expect one film to change government policy.
Film is one small voice in a great cacophony of noise from newspapers, from the television, from social media. So it can have a little dent, you know, it can help to create a climate of opinion, it can maybe trigger a question or two, but it can't do more than that unless when people leave the cinema they carry it further.
They seem to be doing just that. I, Daniel Blake, has sparked public debate about the welfare system in the press and on the floor of Parliament, and it's been seen by more moviegoers in Britain than any of Ken Loach's previous films. For NPR News, I'm Howie Moshkowitz.